Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 75, I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Sandra Dubovi. He discusses training as an ocular pathologist and medical retina specialist, the pathology of Zika virus in the eye, and his philosophy on education. Please remember that in honor of our one-year anniversary, we want to hear from you, the listener. So please fill out a short two-minute survey available on our website and Facebook page that will help us gain insight into how we can continue to improve and serve you with useful and valuable content. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Sandra Dubovi. Dr. Dubovi is the Victor Curtin Professor of Ophthalmology here at Bascom-Palmer. He's also the Medical Director of the Florida Lions Eye Bank. And not only a medical retina specialist, but also an ocular pathologist. Dr. Dubovi, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So we always ask our guests why they went into ophthalmology, but I have to ask you a dual question, which is, how do you end up as an ocular pathologist? How do you end up doing residencies in two different fields?
So I was interested in ophthalmology. I had been interested in that since I was a child. When I went to medical school, I remember back when I was in elementary school and I got glasses, and I always thought all the instrumentation was very interesting, and that kind of got me involved and interested in ophthalmology. And when I did my residency in ophthalmology, which I did first, when I was a resident, we spent a fair bit of time doing eye pathology as a first-year resident. And I thought it was very interesting. I liked the whole idea of being able to look at tissues, and was almost like looking at could see the changes, which were correlated quite well with what you saw in the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was kind of like looking at gross pathology.
Who did you work with?
I worked with Mark Cho a little bit in Chicago. And I spent a little bit of time with Mark Cho, and I felt that it might be a good idea to take a year when I finished ophthalmology residency and do your eye pathology. Quite frankly, I figured in a year I could learn everything I need to learn. And during that year, I started realizing that my general pathology principles, my general pathology knowledge was, there was a lot of room for opportunity, a lot of opportunity for improvement. And I really didn't understand a lot of basic stuff. And so it became apparent after a few months that, well, after, let's say, 6 months, that at the end of that year, I would not know, wouldn't feel super comfortable doing pathology. And so I talked to one of my, one of the attendings, and he said, you know, there will probably be few places that will have eye pathology as we saw contraction and dissolution of a lot of the laboratories.
They saw it even then, they were seeing that.
Yeah, this is back in the 40s. Mm-hmm. Okay. yeah, this is back in the mid 90s.
Right.
And I realized that I could do another year of eye pathology, but that really wasn't the problem. The problem was understanding general pathology. Mm-hmm. So I looked into it and I realized that I could, if I spent some time doing general pathology, that it would probably help me to have a firmer, a more solid groundwork in pathology. So I was able to do 2 years of anatomic pathology, mm-hmm. and then get my boards. So it would do two things. Number one, it really, the most important thing was I understood pathology much better. I became a much better eye pathologist because I understood basic pathologic principles. But it also got me board certification, which has been very useful, you know, as I've progressed, you know, to walk into a pathology department and have the same certification, allow you to run a laboratory in a little easier way.
People sometimes worry, it's a non-traditional path, right? And people, a lot of times who are in residency, feel concerned about taking time to do something else, whether it's another residency and enhance their training, or yeah, taking a break to pursue some sort of other endeavor. Their worry is, I'm going to have these skills, am I going to lose them, am I going to atrophy, am I falling behind? But you then went and did a medical retina fellowship, and did you feel any kind of adjustment period as you went back?
Yes. So it was, I mean, I talked to my chairman at the time. I did ophthalmology, did a year of eye pathology. Then I did 2 years of general pathology. And I was away from seeing patients for a couple of years. When I did eye pathology, I did spend a day, I think it was a half a day a week in the clinic. So I had some upkeep with that, but it's not, I wasn't in the operating room. And during general pathology, I had no interaction with patients. And I remember when I was probably in my second year, I hadn't really seen patients in a while, and I went to take a cytology course before my boards. And I visited a friend of mine who was one of my friends from residency, and I saw some patients with him for about a week. And the first couple of days I was in there, I actually had a problem using the indirect, which I found very disconcerting.
Right.
And I was really, I was upset because here I was, my ophthalmology skills were somewhat lacking. I wasn't a great pathologist, but, you know, I think that it can happen. But I think that if you have the skill set, it'll come back. And within a couple of days, I was fine. Mm-hmm. But it really was concerning during that time. And I remember that somewhat fondly and somewhat with a fair bit of concern that did happen.
So you go to Moorfields?
Yeah. So after I finished with my residency in pathology. I took my boards, my anatomic pathology boards, right before I finished my residency. And then I went off and I went to Moorfields for a year to work with Alan Bird doing medical retina. And so normally after you finish taking a board exam, you kind of relax, but I got to sit down and read Gass and a couple of other books before I started retina because I hadn't seen patients mm-hmm. in a couple of years. And while there, I did medical retina and I did work doing research in pathology as well. I didn't want to lose those skills. Mm-hmm. And so I spent time with the pathology people, Philip Luthert, who was up until recently the head of the Institute of Ophthalmology, was running pathology there. And he'd spent time with Dick Green at Hopkins, which is where I trained in eye pathology. Mm-hmm. And he'd been there about 2 years before me. And we started chatting and we thought it'd be a nice combination. So I did my clinical work with Alan Bird and the other medical retina people there. And I also worked doing some research in the pathology group, and I would sign up pathology as well. So it was the 1 year where I actually was doing what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And then I spent a year there.
Now you've been at Bascom Palmer, how many years now?
So since 2000.
So 17 years. This is your 17th year now.
Yeah.
And you took over for Victor Curtin, who was...
Actually, there was...
You overlapped for a little bit.
Well, Victor Curtin, he finished in 2000. In 1996, he retired. Mm-hmm. And there was actually someone in between the two of us. Robert Rosa, who's now in Texas, he worked there for 4 years and he ran the laboratory. He decided to move. He was a former Bascom resident mm-hmm. and he wound up going back to, he's back at Scott and White. He went back for family reasons. And so then the spot opened up and I got a phone call and decided to come.
You referenced the contraction of eye pathology labs. It's a dying field. I remember when I was interviewing for residency, I met Ben Glasgow from UCLA and he was like, there's very few of us left. Which is a bit of a shame, right? Because you always talk about how pathology, and you mentioned this earlier, teaches us more about disease, right? We learn things from that. But now that there are less and less labs, you probably get more and more cases that come specifically here versus, you know, there's just less options for people to send these cases. Sometimes, do you ever feel like it's a problem or the way things are processed or a problem when the slides come to you from outside? Do you have any advice for someone who'd want to send cases in terms of how to get them to a lab properly?
It's a great question. What happens is in eye pathology, in the older days, a lot of departments had an eye pathologist or an eye pathology laboratory. Mm-hmm. And that was because, you know, reimbursements were such that the finances of departments were such that they could finance something like that. And what's happened with time is that those have been cut. Both people doing eye pathology don't want to spend the time necessarily doing it in some cases because there isn't the reimbursement on the back end. And I think also is that the cost of the laboratory, most of the laboratories have been folded up into general pathology because there's been consolidation in pathology laboratories in general, not just mm-hmm. eye pathology, but in general pathology, sometimes you'd have in a GYN laboratory or you'd have an autopsy laboratory, but then they centralize them because the economy is scaled. And that's what's kind of happened. I think that finding somebody that feels comfortable doing the material, if you, like, let's say you're in a particular hospital, if you mm-hmm. could find somebody that's interested that will take special interest in what you're doing, you're more likely, if you forge a relationship with a pathologist, that will make things easier. Mm-hmm. Or you find a laboratory that's dedicated to ophthalmic pathology. And so, like our lab, there's different laboratories across the country, and you find someone that's close by and send the stuff to them, and you're more likely to get the material handled appropriately. Because one of the problems with eye pathology is it's usually very small tissues.
Right.
And so some places they don't feel comfortable, A, with the nomenclature or the anatomy or the disease processes, or handling very, very small pieces of tissue. And so that's what usually winds up being helpful. But there are a handful of laboratories and some very good people across the country to send to.
In terms of, so we're going to transition talking about your recent publications. You're a senior author in this paper in JAMA Ophthalmology talking about the Zika virus, which has been very hot in the news over the past year. and talking about the pathology findings in an infant who had Zika. Dr. Capella Ventura, Nina Baracol, Maria Fernandez were all also in the paper. Maria was the first author. You were the senior author. What did the pathology there tell us about Zika and its disease?
So we basically, we worked with the National Institute of Health in Bogota, Colombia. And we they have a number of, they've worked with the people at the NIH here in the United States, looking at the brain findings and findings in the placenta. And we were able to get fetal demise, you know, fatal demise cases. We got four cases where they had had abortions because of first trimester diagnosis of Zika and seeing that there was abnormalities. And we were given, we were able to get four eyes from infants that were diagnosed by both PCR and serologic testing to have Zika. So we knew that these kids already had Zika. And we got the eyes. And the only thing that had been published before this was two cases, one from these guys and one from somewhere else, was to show that the Zika virus is present in the retina. And the question was, well, how about everything else? And so we got the four cases and we did a couple things. We looked morphologically. We looked at the histopathologic findings to begin with. And we were able to look for, you know, structural abnormalities. We found atrophy of the optic nerve, which is what you would expect to see because a lot of these kids have optic nerve atrophy. There was thinning and hypopigmentation of the retinal pigment epithelium. There was some choroidal thinning. There was some outer retinal thinning or retinal atrophy. And there was also inflammatory. There's inflammation in these tissues, the in the optic nerve, the choroid, but in the retina. And also we saw some inflammation in the iris. There were also findings that were associated with, you know, first trimester, you know, because of the embryologic stage they were at. So there was pupillary membranes and some other changes that we tossed out because we felt that that was, you know, you see those in normal cases. And then equally or more importantly, we looked at, we did immunostaining, immunofluorescence staining to look to see where we could isolate the virus. And we found the virus in the optic nerve. We found it in the choroid, in the retina, and in the iris. And that, the presence of the virus in those tissues associated with inflammatory cells in those tissues and associated with varying amounts of atrophy makes it seem to be that the virus is likely involved in the morphologic findings that we typically see in the congenital Zika syndrome. But, you know, there are limitations in the study or the fact that we had a small number and there is autolysis or breakdown of the tissues, you know, with problems with fixation. But it appears to be that those findings are probably probably causal. And then the most one of the interesting things is that, you know, we found in the iris. And the question is, well, do you really see many things in the iris? But you can see an anterior uveitis with these patients. And we do see that sometimes in older in people that contracted later. And so it appears to be have a tropism to the iris tissue as well. And that was actually, interestingly, where the staining was greatest. And that plus the inflammation. So that may be the reason why there are these, why the kids get, or people can get these iris changes and inflammation in the anterior segment.
You know, a lot of people go into ophthalmology because they like objectivity, and pathology is probably the most objective part of what we do. There's some subjective interpretations, but you either stain positively, you don't, you have better staining or worse staining in a tissue. You referenced earlier, you talked about how when you were in Moorfields, you read GAS or you had to read these textbooks. And I remember you told me as a resident, and this is kind of going into your role as an educator, I asked, you know, what did you read to know this? Or what? And you said, oh, I went back to Robbins when I was a medical student or starting pathology. I read Robbins. I read the big text. So if my generation, which was, you know, educating in the 2000s, was the Cliff Notes generation, we're now in the iWiki and Wikipedia generation, right? Everyone wants something short and simple and easy to digest. I mean, this podcast is an example. I think people want something they can digest quickly. But there is a value to going back to the literature and also going back to these texts where people have actually written out things beautifully, explaining, you know, having that understanding of why something happens can be very important. Sometimes it's lost as you start tapering it down, you lose kind of the bigger picture as you do that.
Oh, I would agree. I mean, I think that whenever I'm looking at a potential research topic or anything else, I try to tell whoever I'm working with or and myself is to read as much as you can about something so you really get it. Because otherwise, you wind up starting don't reinvent the wheel if you don't have to.
Right, right.
And there's so much in the literature, and there's so many things you can read and so much information out there. Usually I can, if I see something that I haven't seen before, usually somebody else has. And they usually have more gray hair than I do, and they've usually written the paper, and I can usually get stuff that way. So I can't, even though we're in a situation now where digestion in small bites is easier, I can't emphasize enough the importance of reading, of going through the literature if you can, because it's usually out there. If you think that something's brand new, sometimes that's not always the case. That's
right. Yeah. And it's funny how things can get reinvented decades later. You know, we'll see this in surgical retina conferences or meetings you go to. Someone will go up, present a new surgical technique, and then you'll have, you know, someone with some more gray hair stand up at the podium and say, you know, Dr. So-and-so talked about this very same thing at this meeting 25 years ago. And it gets lost. It gets lost somewhere along the way. And maybe it's not a bad thing to bring back things that were talked about before. Maybe you have a new angle. Maybe you have something different. But you're right. I think the biggest mistake people make is they just do a quick PubMed search or whatever. Even if they're doing their due diligence, you only go back as far as you can read the articles. Maybe they've only been scanned since 1995. But they've been writing about it going back to the 70s or 60s. And you just don't have access to them without doing something that seems crazy to us, which is go to a library and find the article. So it's interesting. You know, the other lesson I took about you, you know, when I give lectures or teach people is repetition, right? One of your things you always talked about was you need to say things a certain amount of time for someone to remember it. And how do you start doing that? Because when you give your lectures, you'll say the same thing. If you really want to emphasize a point, you'll say it literally 3 or 4 or 5 times in a row. And you repeat that over and over again. And I'm just curious how you started doing that.
Well, I got that from a professor of mine in medical school. When I took anatomy, there was a gentleman, I'll give you his name, Lawrence Prutkin. He was one of my professors when I was a medical student. He passed away probably 10 years ago. But he would always say things 3 times. And he was the best professor we ever had. And everybody joked that we wanted him to teach everything. Because it didn't matter what he was teaching. Right, right. He was just a good teacher. And actually in the medical school yearbook, they had his name there and they said, Lawrence Prutkin, Lawrence Prutkin for emphasis, because he would say, you know, say things 2 or 3 times. And I found that to be, as a, you know, remembering back when I was a student, to be the most useful way to learn something. Because sometimes you go to lectures and you'd walk out and say, okay, I got a lot of information, but I need to make sure I learn it by rereading it. But if someone repeats things over and over again, if you can walk out and you already know it, then you've really gained something. Because I found that there's 2 ways of doing it. I hope that when people walk out of my lectures, that they understand this material. They don't have to go home and read about it,
right,
but it's there. And that's what I'm really trying to do. And I know you do the same thing with your teaching, and that's what I got that from him. Someone taught me how to do that.
Right.
And the way I've learned how to lecture is by good professors that I've learned from. I remember and take a piece from him, a piece from him, a piece from him, and say, you know, that's the way. And then you develop your own style.
Mm-hmm.
But I find repetition to be very, very useful. And people think I perseverate, but that's really just for teaching purposes.
Now, disclosure, you do write for the boards, but at times, and you've written for the Basic Science series for pathology.
Yeah.
One of the subjects people, if you look at people nationwide taking ophthalmology boards, they say is most difficult. They'll talk about pediatrics, they'll talk about optics, and pathology is often, you know, one of the things that people say. Nationally, the scores tend to be lower. People tend to struggle more in pathology compared to other things. And I have 2 questions for you. One, why do you think that is? Do you think that has to do, again, with the principles in medical school being lost sometimes? And 2, what do you think people can do? If they don't have access to an eye pathologist who's going to teach them hands-on, what would they do to kind of overcome that?
That's a good question. You know, it's interesting, as I ask the students that come through, I know that pathology is becoming, as medical education changes, there is, pathology has, in some schools is still a standalone course.
Right, right.
In some places it gets rolled into, you know, mechanisms of disease.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, usually pathology is probably pushed a little bit more to the side. And actually in some places they're not even using microscopes anymore. And actually I think that's actually a number of places where they just use Kodachromes. And so there's a little bit of a less emphasis on that. I think that probably the reason if people are not as involved with pathology or not, they don't learn it as well, it's probably from a couple of possibilities. Number one is there may not be access to an eye pathologist, and so there isn't the education. Number two, as far as interest is concerned, if it's between refractive surgery or mm-hmm. retinal and eye pathology, let's not kid ourselves what people are going to be more interested in. And I think that those are probably, I think it's access to someone's teaching and also probably interest level. Mm-hmm. If things are spoon-fed or things are taught to people, they're more likely to do it. I think that the way if you can get to some type of lecture, that's always helpful. I think that what I found to be useful is if you get an atlas of eye pathology, when you're reading about retina, look at the pictures and it correlates quite well. And usually it helps solidify what you know clinically.
Right, for
retina example, when you look at a CRVO, if you look at the pathology and you see that there's a clot anterior to the lamina cribrosa, which leads to the dilatation of the veins, the cotton wool spots, and the hemorrhages in four quadrants, and then maybe the macular edema, then it makes sense. And if you can put it into context rather than just memorizing something which you're going to forget. So I try to, when I look at the pathology, hopefully contributes to the understanding of the disease process.
And anatomy and pathology are so intertwined, right? I remember that as a resident when I started. You're trying to learn all these different pathologies, but I felt like I didn't really put together these disease processes until I actually understood where things were in the eye and how they connected. And pathology helps with that, because when you know where there's a problem somewhere, it helps you remember where that thing is in the eye, because the eye is so small, you think it's not that complicated. And it really isn't once you break it down and understand the dynamics of different relationships. For example, you used to talk about, where is the ciliary body encircled? The scleral spur. And you know, when you get that separation, you can get the cyclodialysis, for example. And then understanding that the iris, the ciliary body, and the choroid are kind of one continuous structured uvea that kind of all connects. I feel like there's no other part of education where that's really taught. And it's critical for understanding, for example, why if someone, for example, you're talking about Zika, maybe has a tropism for the iris and the choroid separately, but it's maybe not super surprising that it has a tropism for both of these uveal tissues, given there's a lot of commonalities there.
Yeah. I think that if people understand the anatomy, the embryology, and then the pathophysiology, and they can all encompass together, it makes them, usually people don't have to memorize as much. And if they understand it, I would rather have people understand what it is. You don't have to memorize things. If you have to memorize isolated facts, you wind up forgetting them. But if you understand the causality and the potential mechanism of disease, things become much more simple, and things that they'll remember and it'll make sense clinically.
Last question, because you've been very generous with time. You wear a lot of different hats. Medical director of the eye bank. You do a busy medical retina clinic multiple times a week. You educate the residents. You run the eye lab. And you're also traveling to meetings and conferences. You're on different committees here at the university. As a young academician, there's other young academicians or even people in private practice who are getting involved in academic type work. More and more, we're stretched thin. There's so many different things that you can do, and there's so many different obligations that are on you. And then besides that, you have a family. You know, you have three kids, you're married. And you used to talk to me about how you have to kind of make these decisions about what you end up doing and what you don't. Obviously, it's personal, individualized decision. But do you have any general advice about how people can start to navigate that as you start your career and you start getting pulled in all these directions?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm not sure that I do it so well. But I think that if one is able to do the things that you like to do, you're more likely to do them well. And, you know, and things that will be able to contribute to where you see yourself going, that will get you to the pathway of where you want to go. The problem is, what does happen is that pathway changes based upon mm-hmm. what happens as you go down the path. But I would say choose what you find interesting and you're going to work hard at it and enjoy, because if you don't, you're less likely to be successful, I think.
Well, Dr. DeBovey, thank you so much for joining me, and I'm sure our listeners will appreciate all of this.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 75 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You will also find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love feedback, so remember that in honor of our one-year anniversary, we want to hear from you, the listener. So please fill out a short two-minute survey available on our website and Facebook page. They'll help us gain insight to how we can continue to improve and serve you with useful and valuable content. Many thanks to Dr. Sandra DeBovey for his time. Thanks to Louis Kai and Mike Minacasa for the great production. Finally, thank you, the listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. It was great seeing many of you at the Academy meeting last week. This is Jay Schrader, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.